So here's the setup.
Okay, so picture this. You are entering a cafe, and this isn't going to be a restaurant where you are seated and have a server. This is going to be a fast casual situation. You place your order, and then they flip a screen around. And the screen will say, "Would you like to leave a tip?" And once that screen is flipped around, a lot of pressures are then placed on you, the customer. So, number one, a pressure might be the person who is standing on the other side of that screen. They're looking at you. They know if you're going to place a tip or not. Number two, what if someone else is with you? What if you're with a friend or a family member? They're also watching. They will see if you leave a tip or not. Number three, usually the screen has some preset amounts suggested. It may be 18%, 24%, 28%. And at this point, you just want your transaction to be completed. So maybe you don't feel like pressing the custom button and going through all the extra steps to add your custom tip amount. You're either going to choose one of those amounts or you're going to tap no tip. And then the person on the other side of the screen who has been waiting for you is going to turn the screen around, complete the transaction, and you're on your way.
This is Camille Trautner, and if you were trying to understand the code of proper behavior in a social situation, you could take a class from her. She's an etiquette coach who lives here in Utah. The COVID pandemic and other factors have created this new environment for tipping. It's really confusing. So we asked Camille to offer a little guidance.
So when you think of all of these societal pressures around tipping, I think a lot of it comes to etiquette. And that is because etiquette is all about making people feel comfortable. So how can you make this employee at this cafe feel comfortable? You can tip them. That shows respect. That shows that you appreciate what they've done. In a way, it also makes you feel comfortable, because you know you've done something that is probably good. If you consult the Emily Post Institute, who's been a longtime standard for etiquette, the Emily Post Institute says tipping should be discreet. And I think that is where we have encountered a lot of problems in society today, because tipping is not discreet anymore. Everyone can see when you tip or not. And you're more likely to be generous if people are watching. But some people argue that that may feel a little bit like extortion. Here is a price that we are charging you for this service or this item, and that may be what you're expecting. And then when you're confronted with this screen or this unsuspecting opportunity to tip someone, that's when the pressure really mounts, because you haven't made a decision. I do think that pre-pandemic, tipping was a lot clearer. Enter COVID-19. A lot of small businesses are really struggling just to stay alive. And we, generous consumers, tip more than maybe we would have pre-2020, because we are trying to help these businesses stay afloat. Well, the pandemic has fizzled out. We are left with all of these tipping expectations that weren't there just a few years ago. And since this is also new, so many people don't know what to do. So I would say my best tipping advice is to decide now, who are you going to tip? How much are you going to tip? When I go to these places, am I going to use the pre-selected options? Do I have a number in my brain? Once you've made all those decisions ahead of time, it's so much easier. It relieves a lot of the pressure, and you can feel good about yourself because you've made that decision ahead of time. What it all boils down to is respect and making people feel comfortable. And if you really want to make someone else feel good about themselves, throw a dollar or two their way, and good luck out there.
That's Camille Trautner. She's an etiquette advisor with the organization Utah Etiquette Classes. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to talk about tipping, about the history, and about the effort of one local cafe to do something different. In a piece he wrote for The New Yorker a few months ago, Zach Helfand said, internalizing all these rules for tipping can be like learning a new language. He says it's so effortful, as you just heard from Camille. But in the piece, Helfand says he can see in that mental math, in the silent negotiations, this lurching attempt at fair play. We're all trying to get this right, but we're also locked into a system a lot of people don't like, and there just doesn't seem to be a way out. Here's Zach Helfand.
You go and make almost any financial transaction, and it seems you're prompted to tip at a lot of them. So this is one of those kind of New Yorker stories where it's something that we encounter every day, and it's so common that it becomes almost background noise. So I really wanted to look at it and examine it critically as one of those daily phenomenon that you start to not even think about anymore because it's so common.
One of the things I like about the piece is you sort of write about the different dimensions of tipping. You mention how, you know, it used to be this kind of delicate private thing, and now it's not that, it's different. But you also say that tips can reveal hidden values, or as you say, the rumblings of the subconscious. Talk about how tips work in that way.
So the tip today is a little bit different because there's this peer pressure.
Right.
When the tablet is turned around, even if some people can't read it, it's glowing, it's kind of big, and it feels like people are sitting in judgment of you. You know, if you're in line for coffee, the people behind you are either going to think, wow, this guy's a sucker, he tipped too much, or this guy is a cheapskate if you don't tip enough. So I wonder if it's changed the psychology of it a little bit. But in the past, there have been studies showing that people tip attractive waiters or waitresses more. If a waitress writes a smiley face on your check, you're going to tip more. In like the 50s, the Mad Men era, men would take out their wives. They wouldn't tip as much, probably because they didn't have to impress the wife. Mm-hmm. And when they would go out with someone else's wife, they would tip more because they wanted to impress her. There are all these ways that I think without thinking about it, people are using the tip to kind of signify their status or their generosity or trying to signal some sort of virtue.
How do you think the COVID pandemic, that era, how did that change tipping? Because it seems to have really altered the situation.
The people that study tipping call it the guilt tipping phenomenon.
Yeah.
So early on in the pandemic in particular, there was an outpouring of support and gratitude for what we called frontline workers.
Yeah.
So that included, you know, nurses, but also the people delivering you your food. People felt bad. So there were these huge tip amounts that you saw on checks coming in. People would tip just $100 just because they felt guilty sitting at home, you know, getting their pizza while someone else was putting themselves at risk. Mm. And that seemed to be sticky, not in the way that I would have expected. I would have expected the percentage of tips to go up. That's actually stayed pretty even. There was a little jump during the pandemic where the percentage of the bill that you would tip increased, but that has normalized to normal levels for things like waiters and waitresses, the classic thing you'd think about when you're tipping. But the big change has been that we just tip a lot more kinds of workers. So workers that you wouldn't expect. There was one study that showed we tip like box office employees. Mm. So at like the movie theater or the theater, some words where you would never think of that. We tip sports coaches and things like that, where you would never think of that in the past. So that's been the big change post-pandemic is the different kinds of jobs and services that we tip now.
You write in the piece that the gratuity has classically functioned as a thank you, but it can also serve as a sorry. What do you mean by that?
So the thank you is, I think, the classic example, and really what we should aspire to.
Yeah.
Is you're doing me this service. I'm recognizing you. I'm meeting you as a fellow human and thanking you for service rendered. Whether it was, you know, really did a good job or you did an okay job, I see you and recognize you. Often it's more functioned as the person buying the service is usually in a higher status than the person rendering the service. Not always, but I think the position of buying some sort of service or good kind of automatically puts you in a higher position, and people feel uncomfortable when you feel above someone, or there's some level of discomfort at least. And so the tip is in some ways a way to alleviate the guilt that someone is waiting on you, for example. To be waited on is awkward. You know, there's another person kind of at your whim, and this is kind of the tax that you pay to alleviate your guilt to that situation.
You know, it's so interesting because there's no canon here. It's not written down, the rules. It's this kind of civic social arrangement at play in a gratuity. And there's this marketing professor you talked to for the piece who studies all of this, and he did some research that showed the more a company asked for, the more the customers would pay, which, like as you said, that dynamic can be compared to masochism. So why is that? Why do we just pay it? How do you understand it?
That's a good question and something that I was really interested in. This marketing professor is a guy named Michael Lin at Cornell, who studied this his entire career, actually put himself through graduate school as a tipped employee. So right. He had firsthand experience with this. I think it's partially this guilt that we feel. Tipping is Americans do tipping better or worse, you know, depending on your perspective, than anyone else in the world. We tip a lot. I think our society is one that's pretty highly stratified. And I do think that there's an element of that guilt there, that people who are buying these services do feel guilty. I also think that people feel good when they leave a big tip. You feel generous. It's partially that. I just think there's also just maybe this is the biggest thing. There's just kind of a you're not really thinking about it. Where if you are given a screen and it gives you three options, you're probably going to pick the middle option, and you're not going to think that much about it unless it's a totally, you know, high number. If it's 20, 25, and 30, and you normally might tip 20%, if it's the middle option, you might just click 25. And studies show that people actually do. Now, if they ask for like 45, 50, and 55%, then maybe you start to reconsider it. So I think it's partially just kind of like we're sheep in some ways, and we'll go along with it. But it is interesting that another study that Michael Lin at Cornell did found that there was a seafood chain, Joe's Crab Shack, and they got rid of tipping at one point, and customer satisfaction went down. People actually felt worse about their experience, even though it was exactly the same, when they weren't tipping. So I think there is some of that. People feel good or generous, or it alleviates some guilt, and that's what's at play there.
I think it was a stroke of genius to call Larry David and ask him about tipping. Say something about that, because he was just totally. I mean, he'd had an experience where he drove a cab, as you say in the piece, for a time, and he was just kind of mystified by the fact that people would give him money.
Yeah, I kind of think of him as like the modern day Emily Post, right? Yeah. He's you know, the comedies of manners is what he makes. And so he if anyone would be cognizant of what the rules are and how it makes you feel, I thought it would be Larry David. So yeah, it never really made sense to him why people were giving him money. He's a stranger. They're never going to see him again. There's really no social cost beyond that moment if you don't want to tip. And then, you know, then you get the money. You get to keep the money yourself. So it never really made sense to him, but he was very pleased as a you know, a young cab driver to get the tips. The thing that he said that resonated most for me is it's not really – I think the thing that aggravates people who are upset or frustrating or annoyed by modern tipping is often less so the money, but that you're made to kind of feel like an idiot. Like if you don't know the rules, you stand in line and you get the tablet turned to you at the coffee shop or wherever you are. And what he said is like, it stops you in your tracks. Yeah. You know, you don't know what to do, and you're made to feel like a moron for not knowing the rules.
Okay, just for the hell of it, say something about the famous people who were famously good or bad as tippers. I thought this was kind of great.
Okay, so there's a phenomenon called the celebrity tipping tax, right, where celebrities have to be good tippers or else it'll leak out and people will know. So, you know, celebrities will tip like 35% when normally people will tip 20. And there's like, so there's a 15% celebrity tax just because you're well-known. Some of the well-known good tippers, Taylor Swift is good, which makes sense. You know, she's extremely famous. It's a small price to pay to keep up the image. Obama was supposed to be pretty good. Mark Twain was bad.
Was bad.
Yeah, he was bad. He would stiff his coachman.
Right.
Back in the day, you'd tip your coachman, and he wouldn't want to tip him. My favorite is Leon Trotsky.
Yeah.
So you think this could go either way, right?
Right.
Like the working man is serving him, and you'd think he might want to tip very generously. But in fact, he thought tipping was a moral abhorrence and that it was propping up. It was basically a subsidy for the owners, and that the workers were debasing themselves by accepting tips. So he lived in the Bronx for a couple months when he was in exile, and he would go to these Jewish dairies. They're like these little penny restaurants, basically, and he would get soup, and he would refuse to tip, and he would actually try to rally some of the other customers to not tip. And so the employees at this restaurant, I guess, didn't really appreciate that very much. They didn't see his wider worldview at play there. They just saw they weren't getting money, and they would kind of walk by him and spill hot soup on him
right,
to get back at him.
Mobsters are apparently good tippers. Who knew?
Yeah, I think they want to impress. You know, you want to be a big shot. I think that's what it is.
Professional golfers are good.
One of my favorite dichotomies was golfers are good, and professional tennis players are you know, reputedly bad.
Yes.
And I think that maybe that's because golfers, you got to tip the caddy.
Right.
So they're used to tipping, where tennis players are not.
Zach Helfand, he's on the editorial staff at The New Yorker. You're listening to Radio West. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the history. Just explain where this practice came from. I mean, this reaches back into the Middle Ages.
Yeah, so as far as we can tell, tipping evolved out of what we call vails. So if you were an aristocrat and you had an estate in Europe, you would, when you'd have visitors at your estate, you would have, the custom would be that the visitors would tip, you know, the footman or the butler who waited on them. So this would kind of lower the payroll for the person who owned the estate. So you have these people over, and they would help subsidize your payroll a little bit because they were paying vails, basically a tip to your staff.
Yeah.
And that evolved into a number of different systems that eventually it went into coffee shops in Europe, where people would tip to get faster service. So you don't want to be served fast. So you want to get your beer or your coffee more quickly. You toss them a little bit of change, and they might serve you more quickly. In France, they had what was called le tronc, which was just a wooden box where you were expected, if you were a customer, to put the money in the box. And I think what a lot of people would assume is that money would go to the waiters who were waiting on you. But actually, the proprietors of the restaurants would kind of take it for themselves, which is what a lot of people think is essentially the modern day tipping system, where the employees get it, but it allows the owners to pay less.
Right.
You know, it's essentially you're subsidizing their payroll. And from there, the Americans who went to Europe, who went to France, they wanted to feel sophisticated and more European, brought the practice back to the U.S. But the thing that really spread, probably more than anything, the practice in the States was the Pullman Company, the railroad company. George Pullman, who owned the company, who's kind of a virile and racist in a lot of ways, and he would insist on hiring only formerly enslaved black men to serve as his porters, and he didn't want to pay them a lot. So what he did was try to popularize this tipping practice that people did sometimes in Europe And because the railroads went almost everywhere, the practice kind of spread throughout the country as he tried to popularize the practice to lower his payroll costs.
But once the practice sort of gets settled in, you know, established, it as you say in the piece, it really becomes hard to dislodge it. So that's where we are now, right? It's hard to get, for some reason, it's been hard to get out of it. Now it's set and no one seems to like it, but we're stuck with it, it seems.
It's kind of like an entitlement where once it's in, you have a class of people, a group of people who are getting their income from it. Mm. And there are a lot of workers who don't like tips for a number of reasons. But there are a lot of workers who do, and in fact make a lot of money from tips. You know, nightclub hosts, in some cases at really high-end nightclubs, can make like $250,000 in tips in a year. So you have a really vocal group of people to whom this matters a lot.
Yeah.
And they're going to make a lot of noise and, you know, understandably not want the system to change. And for the vast majority of other workers, it's uncertain. You know, you know what you're going to get with tips because that's the system you were dealt with.
Mm.
So even if you might not love it, it might be preferable to the unknown. So it's just really hard to get rid of once it's in.
I mean, what seems to happen is that when it comes to minimum wage standards, Europe goes one way and we sort of went another. They raised minimum wage. We lowered the base wage for tipped workers. Does that tell part of the story? Again, the idea of employees relying on consumers to pay a wage maybe they should be paying.
Definitely. And that is one way that it makes it easier to get rid of tipping is by raising the minimum wage. That's what happened in Europe.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why tipping is not really a big phenomenon there. One of the craziest figures that I found or learned through reporting this is, and this varies by state, but nationally, the tipped minimum wage in the U.S. is $2.13 an hour. So if you are an employee and you earn tips, your company only has to pay you $2.13 an hour so long as you're getting enough, you know, tips to equal the regular minimum wage.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is there's so many different laws. So different states mm-hmm. have different mm-hmm. minimum wage standards for tip workers. Nationally, there's a different standard that I think it's hard for consumers to know what they should be tipping based on what the minimum wage is. So
yeah.
California is one state, for example, that has raised the minimum wage for tipped workers pretty highly, and it had no effect on tipping. People still tip as much as ever. And I think just because it's so confusing.
Yeah.
If you know that the worker is making a good living wage, then you might not tip as much. But workers, I mean, customers just don't know.
Yeah. You write about some of the efforts in the past to stop tipping. In the early 1900s, there were, I think it was like six states who tried to outlaw tipping. One of them had a penalty where you could spend 30 days in jail if you were the person who did the tipping or if you were the person who received the tip. Like, these guys were serious.
Yeah, people really hated it when it first came to the U.S. and started being popularized. There were organizations like Tippers Anonymous and the Anti-Tipping Society. There's one called the Nationwide. I think it's called the Nationwide Operation to Instill Pride, which the acronym there is No Tip.
Yeah.
People really tried to they made more of an organized, concerted effort than we have today to get rid of tipping. The problem is I looked for someone who was jailed for 30 days for accepting or giving a tip, and I couldn't find one. I think it's pretty hard to prosecute someone's generosity. It's maybe not a winning battle if you're a district attorney or a county sheriff or something like that to try to throw someone in jail for that. So those efforts didn't really work, and I wonder if they had been appealed to the Supreme Court if they would have held up. But there was this big effort to try to stop tipping, but that even that didn't work. You know, they eventually all the states repealed these laws.
Well, so say something about the modern. One of the things you mentioned in the piece are these a couple of these solutions that are being proposed these days, and one of them is to go back to that. Like, let's ban it altogether. You mentioned California, Nevada, I think has tried to do the same thing, but. I guess it just doesn't seem to work.
It doesn't seem to work. And there have been some efforts like this, but it's so ingrained that I think unless it was a national thing, it would be really hard. And there'd have to be an education campaign too, which is probably more trouble than you know the Congress wants to go through. There have been some local efforts. But you know, if you're an out of towner, or if you're just not paying that much attention, you're just going to tip anyway.
Yeah.
At a lot of places, the best efforts have been individual efforts. So individual restaurants or chains or businesses have tried to go to no tipping policies. Danny Meyer, who's a big restaurateur in New York, he created Shake Shack,
right.
With some national people might probably recognize him most for. He hates tipping. He thinks, you know, he wants to pay his people well, and he doesn't want to leave their compensation, his employees' compensation, up to the whims of the customers. And he tried to get rid of it, and it worked for maybe 5 years, but it's tough if you're a business owner and you try to get rid of tipping, because then you have to raise your payroll costs yourself to be competitive with your competition, and you probably have to raise menu prices to compensate for that. And people don't know when they're just looking at the menu online. Oh, this includes the tip. I don't have to pay 20% more, and they might go elsewhere because the prices look high. So it's pretty hard. There was one coffee shop that I went to in New York that got rid of tipping. There's a no tipping policy. They have signs all over the place. And still, there are some customers who insist on handing over the money, or they'll hide it underneath their cups or their plates. So when people clear off their tables, there's just, you know, a $5 or $10 bill. So people, you know, go to great lengths to keep this going. There's something psychological where people feel obligated.
Well, it goes to something Danny Meyer told you. He said that tipping is a drug. It's like it's addicting for some reason.
Yeah, and he mentioned it's kind of addictive for everyone. The customer gets, you know, the dopamine hit of the generosity. The employees feel like, you know, they're getting more, even if in some cases they might not be, but they feel like they've earned this and that they have the opportunity to get higher. You know, instead of getting a fixed wage, you have the chance to get more. And for the business owners, it's useful because it lowers payroll costs. So he said it's kind of, you know, it's addictive for everyone, and it's hard to wean off on all sides.
Another idea, and the reason I mentioned it is because there's one of our guests on the show has tried this, is trying this, and that's a service charge. There are some really well-known restaurants, Chez Panisse, Alice Waters Restaurant, for example, they're trying this service charge. They've tried it. Do you think that will work? I mean, it's so interesting because, like, Chez Panisse, their service charge is now 17%. A tip would be 20%, and I'm guessing people are like, "Well, what's the difference?" Like, what do you think about the service charge idea?
One of the nice things about the service charge idea, especially for restaurants, is, and this varies by where you are, but in New York, for example, if I leave a tip, that only goes to tip eligible employees, which is essentially what's referred to as front of the house employees.
Right.
So people who interact with the customer, mostly waiters. There are some borderline cases, like if you're the sushi chef, are you front of the house or back of the house? Because people could see you working, and maybe you're interacting with the customers and maybe not. And it's actually a very heavily litigated area, the sushi chef.
Yeah.
And the line cooks, the chefs, you know, everyone in the back of the house, it can't share in that tip money. Most of the time, a lot of people don't know, in restaurants, tips are pooled. So you think you're tipping your individual waiter, but they're kind of putting it all into a pool and divvy it up among themselves. And the people who are making your food, who are doing this kind of, to me, like intimate act, you know, they are touching and preparing the stuff that you're going to ingest. Mm. They're not tipped, and they end up making less money than the front of the house people, even though in a lot of cases they, you know, they have to go to culinary school. There's more education and higher barriers to entry to be a cook than a waiter. They're not involved. So the service charge, again, there are a lot of legalities involved, but the service charge in a lot of cases allows you to spread the money that would otherwise be coming in from tips, be spread out more evenly among all the staff. And that was also one of the things Danny Meyer wanted to accomplish, mm-hmm. was to bridge that pay gap between front of the house and back of the house staff. In New York, I was shocked to learn that on average, the front of the house earns twice as much as the back of the house. So the waiters earn twice as much as the cooks, which to me seems wrong. There shouldn't be that disparity there.
So let me ask you finally, do you think this these little acts of revolution, you know, this effort to reform the system ever really could work? Because as you said, you know, you've got these, you're going to have to rely on these individual circumstances of people doing it. But if everyone doesn't get on board, because there are so many incentives here to not, and there's this, you know, big lobbying effort and all kinds of things that are sort of going against it, but someone has to act first, because it doesn't seem like you can regulate it, you know, mandate it. So I guess that's the question. Do you think this thing could work, this effort to reform it?
I don't. I applaud people who are trying to find a more equitable system. And I also think that they are doomed to fail in many cases. I think it could work on individual bases. So for your business, you know, if you want to institute this policy, I think it might work for your business. But I think it's going to be hard to keep up that policy for the long term. And I just based on past experience, I don't think it's likely to catch on. I think if you can accept tips in your business, in a lot of cases, is easier and allows you to kind of undercut the competition. So there's just too many incentives for this system to keep on going.
Zach Helfand, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Zach Helfand, he's on the editorial staff at The New Yorker. We'll put a link to his article on our website, radiowest.org. You're listening to Radio West. So one of the things we were talking to Zach Helfand about was just how difficult it was to dislodge the practice of tipping once it was established. As he pointed out, there are these efforts to reform the system, and we found one here in Salt Lake City. Riley Syme is the general manager at the Rose Establishment. It's a cafe in Salt Lake City. And a couple of years ago, she helped the restaurant develop an alternative to tipping because, like a lot of people, she hates it.
For me personally, I value so much the experience of dining out. I think it's what makes life good. Yeah. And I think it's strange that in order to do that, in the back of your mind, you're clocking whether this is good service or bad service. The bill comes and you're like, that was so lovely. Here's my price. And now I got to consider, like, what do I think of that server?
Yeah.
And I just think that's a weird relationship to have with dining. Usually you buy a product, you get the product, you go home. And yeah. you're not thinking about whether the service that was provided when you bought that product was good enough or bad enough to justify paying that person. And because I think that's what it comes down to. Ultimately, we're saying, like, is the service good enough or bad enough to pay them their wage? And I think that is very strange that the consumer decides if a person gets paid to work. I don't, you know, yeah. I just don't think we have anywhere else where that happens.
It's like when you go out,
mm-hmm.
now set apart the part of you that is in this business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but when you just go out,
mm-hmm.
what do you notice when you go to a coffee shop or when you go any place, I guess, you know, there's a tip jar or there's an option. And like at establishments where there's just counter service, like they just hand you a thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's sometimes when they make you a thing, like they go back and make you a latte or – but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're just handing you the thing, but then there's the option. Like, what are the rules? It's really hard to – like, what do you see? What do you notice about all of that?
I think it is hard for me to remove myself fully from the context
right,
of that.
Of
and
course.
I think if I see the ability to tip, my feeling is I know that they're not getting paid.
Yeah.
Actually. If we are being offered –
Wait, even if they're at a counter.
Yeah.
And they're just – here's the thing. If there's an option for a tip, you're wondering – they're probably relying on that.
Yes.
Okay.
It's impossible for me not to.
Because, right.
I would say maybe they're not making the sub-minimum wage that a server makes, $2 an hour.
Yeah.
But they might be making $8 an hour.
Yeah.
They're not making a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I know they need that tip.
Yeah.
Their job is actually based around that tip. That when they were hired, the manager told them what they're going to be getting on average around in tips. They're clocking how much they're going to take home at the end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's hard to remove myself because I do think when I see the tip screen, I know that this is just part of the transaction of this experience. On a normal consumer level, if I were to remove that, I also get the frustration in seeing something like that because I think this is where tipping is also strange. It's like, what is service? What does it mean to be served and what are we valuing? What is the point of the tip?
What is the point?
Yeah. And ultimately, like the way that the system is built right now is the tip is the wage. I think that there's this idea that tip or gratuity is extra. It's a bonus. It's a thank you for good service.
Mm-hmm.
But that the reality is the worker relies on the tips to make a wage. And I think that's where the confusion lies because as a consumer, as a customer, you're like, what am I getting served here? You said hi to me.
Yep.
You might go make my coffee. Was that good service? Should I tip? Am I giving you a extra for this? And I get why there's frustration there because it's confusing because the reality is you're not giving extra. You're giving the wage.
Okay, so back up for a second and sort of give us a sense of how you think we got here. I think one of the things you mentioned is you go back like this kind of started in the Great Depression.
And it actually started way earlier than that. But what's really interesting and I'm not an expert about this. There are people who actually study this. But like from the beginning of time, these kinds of jobs have been for, I'm putting in air quotes, entry level positions for people who are in difficult situations probably to begin with. They don't get to have an education. These are the jobs that are available to them.
Mm.
And we have, from the beginning, been like, well, we won't pay you for your labor then. And we'll put it on the consumer, wink, wink, and then that's how you'll get paid.
Yeah.
And then in the Great Depression, when we passed minimum wage laws, what happened with minimum wage is they were like, well, with serve jobs, tip-based jobs, we'll still make it that as long that the base wage will be what they get plus tips equals the minimum wage. But then that has almost never changed.
Yeah.
I think 1960 was the last time that the sub-minimum wage was lifted. So that has never been shifted, and people actively work to not shift it. They want to keep that sub-minimum wage low. It benefits a lot of people.
Yeah.
The worker is not one of them.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because it seems like this is, of course, it's more than just individuals with different opinions about tipping, that there is these larger special interests who want it to stay this way, even to the point where there's a lobbying effort underway. What do you understand about that larger sort of interest that wants to keep this system the way it is?
Yeah. I mean, this is where also there's so much information that I don't know, but I think it was the New York Times that did expose that they found that ServSafe, the company where most servers, people in back house, get their certificates to serve food, their food handlers permits, that is a company that pays money to lobby to keep sub-minimum wage low. I think clearly that means that there is people who are benefiting from keeping these wages low. The big entities in the restaurant world, they have a lot more access to cheap cost of goods that the local restaurant doesn't have. They have systems built that their profit margins are so much higher, and they benefit hugely by putting the tip on the consumer and leaving their front of house labor to be low. And I think what's happening right now with tips and why people are feeling so frustrated is because I think that we felt okay collectively to, we understood like our server is smiling at us and filling our water, and at the end of the day, we write a tip at the check. Yeah. What's frustrating now is you go to anywhere, the laundromat, mm-hmm. the Little Caesars, yep. and you're seeing a tip screen, and all of a sudden, you're like, why? What is the tip again? What am I doing here? Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a collective conversation that we need to be having, that we are not raising prices to match what needs to happen. I think costs are rising, and so we adjust, the businesses adjust to accommodate costs first and labor last. The last thing you want to do is a business is raise your prices. It's uncomfortable for the business. It's uncomfortable for the consumer. No one has extra money. I think the consumer doesn't feel like they have extra money. I don't have a solution to that, but I think that you're seeing more tip screens and more businesses because the cost of them being in business is going up, and them raising prices is something they want to be doing slowly, and yet their staff needs more money. They are not able to pay them a level. Tips are a really easy solution to that. It'd just be easier if we were real about what things cost and just paid what they cost. Again, we're afraid to raise our prices, so we ask for a tip. Is that not raising prices? You're paying the same amount at the end of the day.
Yeah. Okay, so before we get to the way you're trying to work this out, let me ask you what you understand about societal expectations and consumer behavior, because it mm-hmm. seems like you, in your business, you have to sort of understand what is the breaking point for a consumer.
Mm-hmm. I think that this is part of the tipping conversation that becomes hard when you are a local business, because I think being local means you are already coming up against the ceilings of the social norms of what we accept as acceptable pricing in food, right? Mm-hmm. I think we all have kind of an idea in our guts of what feels good for a cup of coffee, a scone, a breakfast sandwich, yeah. a piece of pizza. I think that there's some wiggle room. Mm. And I think that the wiggle room is, oh, I'm willing to pay more because it's local. I'm willing to pay more because it's thoughtfully sourced or high quality. How much more? It's hard.
Yeah.
I think people do have a limit. And I think it also depends on the business. If you're fine dining, you know what you're getting into.
Right.
You know what to expect. When you're just a coffee shop.
Totally.
What yeah. does the average consumer even understand the nuances between specialty coffee and Starbucks? You know what I mean?
It's absolutely.
And I don't blame people for not knowing that. I think that there's a lot that we're negotiating in our lives all the time. And so as a business, you do think about that a lot. And I think ultimately we do have to exist in that range that people feel is comfortable and acceptable, and you're just constantly riding that line of what is the average consumer going to feel good about paying for something, even with those other factors taken into consideration. Because at the end of the day, if you can get a breakfast sandwich for a few bucks at McDonald's, what can we offer in a breakfast sandwich that's worth four times that?
Yep.
So yeah, it's a constant negotiation.
So when did you first start thinking about this? Like, you hated the system the way it is now. But that's another thing to start thinking, I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to change it. So how did that work for
you? Yeah. I was never actually from restaurants. I didn't work in restaurants. I came to the Rose pre-COVID as sort of like a temporary fill into, like, I was basically a consultant to help them with some operation administrative stuff.
Right.
And one of the big things that were coming up at the time was staff's unhappiness with pay. And I thought it was so interesting because the back of house was making so little. Front of house, base-wise, from the company, wasn't making very much, again, like $8-$9. But tips-wise, some days they were walking out with, at the time, something that felt so good. And I was like, they're so unhappy though. Like everyone is unhappy with their wage, even though sometimes they're walking away with like money that's crazy. But then on the bad days, it's so low.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about how to solve this. And I, in general, found tipping to be such a strange practice being even inside of it at all. And that coming from any other field, any other service good, any other service-based job or any other like product-based job, you just get hired at a wage. You get hired and you're like, you're going to make X amount of dollars a hour, a year. And you just know that's what you get paid to work that job. And right. So seeing people's dissatisfaction inside of it with what they were getting paid, and then seeing how other places were just had stable wages, I was like, why can't this just have stable wages? Why can't you just say this is how much money you get paid and find a wage that is happy for everyone and then build the business around it? Then COVID happened.
Yeah.
And we had to start basically from scratch. And that was a luxury. To start from scratch means you already know what business model you have. You already know what your customer base is. You already know what you want to serve. But now we can be like, okay, how can we shift? And the way I started thinking about it is like, I just want stability. I want the staff to have stability. I want back of house and front of house to make similar wages. And so we just chose a number based off of, at the time, how much you need to make if you're working full time to have a one bedroom apartment in Salt Lake City.
Wow.
That was the number. It was $19 an hour.
Yep.
I don't think that's right now, but 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, that was the number.
Okay.
And so we're like, okay, I want to get close to that. I want to figure out how to structure this so that people can be making basically $19 an hour. And I did a lot of research about the no tip movement because we weren't the first. Like, there are many, 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 many people who are trying to push no tip, and people who have tried lots and lots of different things.
Right.
I just wanted to build enterprise. We all wanted to build enterprise. Like,
because that's the easiest
that's
way.
That's the easiest way.
Yeah, it's just like, make let's this just, thing more yeah. and then it'll add up to that.
And, yeah. And this is reality. No tip. You don't have to pay anything. This is how much it costs.
But you couldn't do
no.
it.
No. And yeah. like, even if people logically understand, like, oh, but like, people are getting paid and it does not matter what your message is.
Because they've gone past their breaking point.
And like, they're just going to look at the number. They might not even read that. They're going to pull up your menu. Yeah. They're going to see your prices and they're going to say, I'm going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So we were like, okay, we can't do that. That's not an option for us. What could be the option?
Yeah.
That's where the service charge became an idea. And I feel like the phrasing of service charge is important to me because it's not gratuity. This is not extra. This
because the words matter.
Yeah.
You. Yeah.
This
okay.
is not. To me, service charge is like, this is the reality of what it costs to pay everyone. And so the service charge is the charge that you are paying to be served, to come out, to dine.
So when I get the bill, here's the food, and then there's the service charge at your establishment.
Mm-hmm.
It's 18% more.
Yeah.
And I guess some people would say, well, what's the difference between that and a tip?
Yeah. And I think it's truly just stability.
Yeah.
It's taking away the option. And some people don't like that. That's mandatory. It's a mandatory gratuity.
Because she wasn't as friendly to me, or he didn't refill my glass. Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I think to that I say, I don't think the consumer should get to decide if someone gets a wage. And the one thing is, we do allow for extra tip on top of that, which I just wanted to do 20% no tip. But people who work in the industry, people who don't work in the industry, tipping is like a drug, I swear. Like, people on a staffing front and on a consumer front, I think there's this feeling of power. I think generally people don't like tipping. It is a weird burden we're all carrying all the time in our experiences. And like, why not just remove it? Let's just get rid of that burden and instead take that option off the table. Just have the prices integrated. And I do think the more they do it, the easier it becomes.
Riley, thank you.
Thank you.
Riley Syme, she's the general manager at the Rose Establishment. It's a cafe here in Salt Lake City. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We'd also love to hear from you. If you have ideas or suggestions, you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.